Community College District versus Bolton.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young will present an argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this case is unique in my experience in the number of complex and important issues that it presents. I can't possibly hope to cover all of them in the time today. I'll discuss three major issues if time permits and, of course, entertain questions on any aspect of the case. Those three issues are the statutory authority for the technology fee, duress, and sovereign immunity. At the heart of this case are questions about whether the district's technology fee required specific statutory authorization, and if so, whether that authorization is to be found in Section 130.123 of the Education Code. Junior college districts in Texas enjoy some measure of home rule authority. They are subject to the Texas Education Agency and to the Higher Education Coordinating Board, as well as to some specific statutory directives. But they are otherwise vested with authority to conduct their own affairs as they see fit. The primary check and balance on the actions of junior college districts, as distinguished from four-year colleges in Texas, is not statutory regulation from Austin, but accountability of local trustees to local voters.
It's hard for me to make sense of that. Why would you give more discretion and latitude to junior colleges than to the University of Texas?
Because, Your Honor, if I don't like what a junior college has done, I can campaign against the trustees for that junior college and have some chance of having my voice heard. If I don't like what the University of Texas does, my choice is to campaign against the governor.
Yeah.
And that is a very different level of political accountability than it is to raise that issue on a statewide basis.
Are you hinging your argument on, or a large part of your argument on the funding source? Because less state funding goes into junior colleges and it relies more on local property taxes that somehow they should be different?
No, Your Honor. It is more to do with the fact that a junior college is a political subdivision, like a school district, like a city, like a county, which is accountable to local voters on a regular basis, where you may expect local issues to receive more attention than they would receive on a statewide basis. So it's a structural issue, not primarily a funding issue. Funding comes in Section 130.003B and its connection to Chapter 54. And to understand the relationship of those chapters, you have to go back in history and see how junior and senior colleges were regulated by statute. Before 1971, the statutory provisions governing senior colleges and junior colleges were wholly separate. Senior colleges were governed by a variety of statutes, junior colleges by the Junior Colleges Act, which was brought into the Education Code when it was enacted in 1969. In 1971, the senior college provisions were moved into the Education Act, and the junior college provisions became Chapter 130, the senior college provisions became various chapters, including Chapter 54. The linkage is 54002, which says Chapter 54 applies to junior colleges only to the extent provided by the funding statute, 130.003B. That section sets forth six eligibility criteria for state funding. One of those is to collect matriculation and other session fees in amounts required by law. Now, the fees required by law are not specified in Chapter 130, so you have to refer back to the fee chapter, which is Chapter 54, but that applies only to the extent provided by 130.003B. Several points about that statute. It imposes no mandates, merely funding eligibility criteria. The consequence of not complying with 130.003B is that in the next funding cycle, you will not be certified by the coordinating board as eligible for an appropriation. It requires that fees be charged in the required amounts, but does not prohibit them from being charged in larger amounts or different fees. So when Section 54002 says Chapter 54 applies to the extent provided in 130.003B, it is as a reference point only in determining eligibility for funding. The overall structure of the code then reemerges. Senior colleges are regulated in their fees by Chapter 54. Junior colleges are regulated in their fees only by a requirement that they charge at least the Chapter 54 fees if they wish to be eligible for state funding.
And if they charge a whole lot of fees otherwise, you're just supposed to turn out the sub fees at the next election.
That's correct, just like if you don't like your city taxes, that's what you do with the city council.
Well, except that if they charge illegal tax at the city, you can soon get that back, right?
Right, but the tax is illegal only if the legislature has affirmatively said it is illegal. Similarly, there is no statute affirmatively saying that a particular fee by a junior college is illegal, or at least these kinds of fees. Even if a specific statutory authority is necessary, it is found in Section 130.123c, which authorizes each junior college district board to fix and collect rentals, rates, charges, and/or fees from students and others for the occupancy, use, and/or availability of all or any of its property, buildings, structures, activities, operations, or facilities of any nation. Now, the respondents concede that this statute on its face authorizes the technology fee. But they argue that other parts of Section 123 show that it is limited to fees pledged to revenue bonds. And they argue that that is necessary to avoid conflict with Chapter 54. But as I've already explained, Chapter 54 is not applicable to junior colleges except as a reference point in determining funding eligibility. So there's no conflict with Chapter 54. Nor do these other parts of Section 123 indicate that the fees which it authorizes must be pledged to revenue bonds. To the contrary, the language of the statute indicates that the use of revenue bonds is clearly optional. The board is authorized, not required, to pledge the fees. The fees may, not must, be pledged. All or any part of the fees may be pledged, which reduces the respondents to arguing that a fee is lawful if 1% of it is pledged, but unlawful if 0% of it is pledged, without positing any rational reason why the legislature would set up such a scheme. When the fees are pledged, they must be at least sufficient to repay the revenue bonds. If junior colleges cannot charge fees under subsection C without pledging those fees to revenue bonds, then it follows that they cannot build buildings or operate programs under section A without financing those facilities or programs from revenue bonds. If somehow that obstacle is overcome, then they cannot charge fees for those facilities and programs. If a junior college district builds a dormitory, for example, out of current revenues, it can't charge dormitory rents. If it builds a stadium, it can't charge its concessionaires a concession fee under the respondent's theory of the statute. A further important point about 123C. This technology fee was, in fact, pledged to revenue bonds. The revenue bond circular is in the record, clearly states that the technology fee was pledged. The respondents attempt to overcome this fact by arguing that it was not pledged in the revenue bond resolution itself. But to achieve that result, they have to take 123 language out of context. If you look at 123B and 123D, those provisions require that fees which are pledged must comply with the revenue bond resolution or order, a very sensible requirement that the order or resolution control the district's actions. But there is no requirement that fees be imposed only in revenue bond resolutions or orders. The second overriding issue in this case is the issue of duress. As a general proposition, a citizen who voluntarily pays a tax or fee cannot sue to recover that tax or fee, claiming that it was illegal. An exception is made in cases of duress. And this court has developed the business compulsion rule, under which if a tax or fee is paid on the pain of the loss of the right to do business, then it is paid under duress and a suit to recover it is permitted. The courts have stressed that duress is a fact-specific inquiry. For that reason alone, the class-wide summary judgment on duress and the class certification were inappropriate. Beyond that, being a junior college student is not a business. It may be like a business for some in the sense of its importance and scope as a part of the student's life, but it is like a hobby for others.
Do you think duress could be proved class-wide in any situation?
It would be very rare, but for example, in the cases that gave rise to duress in the 30s, where the statute says an out-of-state corporation shall, as a condition of doing business in Texas, pay this franchise fee, then on a class-wide basis, everyone subject to that statute is being threatened with deprivation of the right to do business in the state. So that kind of a case could be class certified. But where the consequences of not paying the fee are individual specific, as they are here.
And how is that? Because you're still going to lose certain interests at the university.
Well, you're going to lose the right to take classes at the college district. How important is that right? Is it comparable in scope to not being able to write bail bonds in the county or to not being able to conduct your insurance business in the state of Texas?
You argue that, well, they could go to another learning institution, but bail bondsmen could go to Ellis County.
Well, but going to Ellis County is a pretty fundamental thing. And it may be a pretty fundamental thing for a particular student who can't get into any of the other institutions to not be able to go to the district. But for somebody else, it may be a pretty trivial thing. If I can't take a course in Portuguese or in photography or something, that may have only a minor impact on my life, whereas someone else, if they can't take classes at the district, they may lose their job, they may lose their welfare benefits, or it may be a major thing for them. The point is, in this kind of a situation, you can't resolve that on a class-wide basis for 270,000 people at once. Turning to sovereign immunity, this court's modern sovereign immunity jurisprudence makes it clear that sovereign immunity from liability exists in all cases unless it has been waived by the Constitution or by legislative action or by the litigation conduct of the governmental unit or by contract.
Does the dispute here come down to whether these fees are like taxes?
I don't think so. I think we concede that there's no difference between taxes and fees for this purpose. Sovereign immunity exists under these modern cases unless the effect of the line of cases from this court about illegal taxes and fees dictates a different outcome. That line originated in two cases from the 1930s involving a corporate charter registration fee, the Austin National Bank case and the Nabisco case. Those were not sovereign immunity cases. In each of those cases, the legislature had recognized the validity of the claim, authorized it, and appropriated money for its payment. And the question before this court was that appropriation valid under the constitutional provision that limits payment of claims to those provided by pre-existing law? And the answer of the court was yes, because those fees were paid under duress. That yes answer is ambiguous when you translate it into the sovereign immunity context. The respondents say that the court was saying there simply is no immunity from liability in illegal tax or fee cases. And that's one possible interpretation. But another is that the court was merely saying that there was a pre-existing law that allowed recovery of payments erroneously made under duress. That is a principle that goes way back. It is applicable to government and private parties alike. And so pre-existing law, as of the 1930s, allowed recoupment of payments made voluntarily but under duress. So the question boils down to, was there no immunity to be waived? Or was the appropriation of money by the legislature an effective waiver of immunity because it was valid under the constitutional provision, because it was provided for by pre-existing law? For the court to reconcile those cases, it needs to hold that sovereign immunity from liability in illegal tax or fee cases exists unless there is a recognized form of waiver.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Roger Mandel is an argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Roger Mandel, and along with my co-counsel, Mark Stanley and Carla Hatcher, I represent the students who brought this suit. Three of those students, Bruce Albright, Bill Bolton, and Helen Bolton, are here today. The students brought this class action as a last resort. The district enacted the technology fee via policy in December of 1993, relying solely upon the Texas Education Code Section 54.504 as the legal basis for imposing that fee. 54.504 allows the charging of incidental fees. In 95, the students brought this to the attention of the Board of Trustees of the district, both in writing at the board and at board meetings, that the technology fee could not possibly constitute an incidental fee. Students pursued this issue with the board for over a year, and the district finally asked for a Texas Attorney General opinion in August of 1996. The students then waited over another year until the Texas Attorney General issued his opinion DM 450 in September of 1997, in which he said that Section 54.504 did not allow the technology fee. At that point, the students expected that the district would discontinue the technology fee and refund the previous 3 years' worth of fees. The district didn't do that. Instead, it simply changed its official policy manual in October of 1997 to reflect Texas Education Code Section 130.123C and not 54.504 as the sole legal basis for its imposition of the technology fee.
Why doesn't that section authorize this fee?
Are you 130.123C?
Uh-huh.
Well, Your Honor, to answer that question, we need to start with the scheme of the Texas Education Code.
Well, let me take you to the part of the argument that troubles me the most, which is you admit in your brief that only part of the revenue has to be pledged to the bonds. A dollar, I suppose.
Well, no, Your Honor. The paragraph is paragraph D of 130.123, and it's not as arbitrary as 1% versus 0%. There's additional language that's the key in paragraph D. And what it says is that...
Together with all other resources.
Yeah, it says that when such resources are pledged to the payment of bonds, they must be in an amount that would be at least sufficient, together with any other pledge resources, to provide for the payments of bonds.
All
so
right,
it's our
right.
position that the fees have to be pledged to the payment of revenue bonds, have to be enacted in the revenue bond resolution, and they have to be in an amount sufficient with other revenues to pay the bonds.
Okay, but that could be a dollar. We're just $1 short of pledging all we need to pay off these revenue bonds, so we'll take a dollar out of the technology fee.
Well, the amount is, I mean, that seems unlikely, but theoretically that's possible. But
well, then what sense does any of that make?
Well, I think the key is paragraph G, which is the incontestability provision.
It only talks about the incontestability of the bonds, not the fees.
Well, Your Honor, the case law says that paragraph G says that they have to review the revenue bonds and the proceedings which enacted them, which would include the revenue bond resolution. The case law, which we've cited for you I'll give you the page of our brief, says that they review all of the proceedings, the way it was enacted. They actually, and if there's any taxes or fees which were enacted as part of this package to pay off the bonds, and that's provided for in the resolution, then the fee or the tax is also reviewed by the Attorney General, and it becomes incontestable as well. Now, the key to this thing is we've got people out there that we want to buy these revenue bonds, and they want to be assured in the marketplace that these bonds have value. Part of that is that they want to know that if fees are pledged, which are necessary to the payment of the bonds, that those fees are going to be there. Because if they're not, then the bonds could become valueless and they're not going to be marketable.
Well, this is another part that troubles me. There were revenue bonds to which these fees were pledged. Is that later?
Later.
But they were approved by the Attorney General.
The bonds, the case law on this says that only what's in the proceedings enacting, that only what's in those revenue bond resolution, that the fee was not enacted in the revenue bond resolution in any set of bonds that were ever approved. Therefore, the fee was not reviewed by the Texas Attorney General, so it didn't become incontestable. That's the problem with and something I don't think the legislature foresaw, which is that somebody would pass a fee 4 years later, pledge it to The payment of pre-existing revenue bonds, which is what happened here. They did a master bond resolution, which is simply said, essentially said, here are some things that we're going to pledge to all of our pre-existing bonds and to all of our future bonds. But it wasn't actually a resolution enacting a specific set of bonds. So the Texas Attorney General never reviewed this fee.
That's where your argument to me falls apart. When you say, well, the sanctity of the bonds and their stability is undermined if we don't read the statute away, but that's not true, it seems to me, because there were adequate revenues already pledged and fees were reviewed and all of that at the time the bonds were issued. So they're sort of standalone, they're secure. Now, what difference does it make from the security of the bonds if the junior college then pledged additional fees that aren't part of this to those bonds to maybe pay down their debt quicker? I mean, that doesn't, to me, undermine the stability of the bonds as issued.
Okay. And I'm not suggesting that the bonds, that any particular bonds issued by the district are in any danger.
That's what your brief said. Not these bonds, but the scheme. And I don't see how the scheme is affected by
that. What we're arguing is that paragraph G, the incontestability provision, is the reason that paragraph D says that if you pledge fees to a bond, they have to be enacted in the bond or resolution.
But just pledging them doesn't make them incontestable. I mean, to me, there are two different kinds of fees that are pledged. There are the kinds that support the bond that you say the case law says are incontestable. And then you can pledge other fees that just by pledging them doesn't mean they're incontestable.
Well, the reason for the requirement in D, which, I mean, I think that's the plain language of the bond. It says when the fees are pledged, they have to be...
It doesn't say you have to pledge, number one, all of the fees.
Well, paragraph D, the pertinent part is fees for the availability of property may be pledged for the payment of set bonds and shall be fixed and collected as shall be determined and provided by the board in the resolution or order authorizing issuance of the bonds. So I think the plain language of paragraph D is saying that the fees have to be fixed and collected as shall be determined and provided by the board in the resolution or order. In other words, the fee that is pledged has to be provided for and enacted by the bond resolution.
The fee that's pledged to support this particular bond issuance that goes through the AG approval process, that doesn't mean you have to pledge all of the fees, seems to me, nor does it mean that you can't enact fees later and pledge them that are not part of this incontestable process.
We rely on B for the proposition they must be pledged. But as far as D goes, which essentially says if they're pledged, they must be in the resolution or order doing it. And then the reason for that is paragraph G, because if it's in the resolution or order, it becomes incontestable. And what the legislature is concerned about is the situation, which could and perhaps often has occurred, where a fee or a tax was pledged, and it was absolutely essential to the payment of those bonds. And what we don't want to have is a situation later on where the fee or the tax can be collaterally attacked, and once that happens, the bonds become worthless. And the solution the legislature came up with was, we're going to have it in the resolution or order and it becomes incontestable. The cases that I'm referring to on the incontestability are at pages 15 to 16 of our brief, and include the City of Galveston case, from 1940, 143 Southwest 2nd at 1035, the Leonard case from Austin, petition denied, 47 Southwest 3rd at 528, the Walling case, 195 Southwest 2nd at 671. And in those cases, there were specifically taxes that were enacted as part of the revenue bond resolution, and those taxes were to be used to pay off the bonds or other things in issue. And somebody came and tried to collaterally attack the tax of the fee, and the court said, no, those are incontestable because they were in the revenue bond resolution, they were reviewed by the Texas Attorney General, and he approved them. And the rationale of these cases is that we have to make sure that these bonds are going to be marketable, and part of the marketability would be if there are certain things that are pledged to them, that are essential to their repayment, that we know that those are incontestable as well. And that's the rationale of the requirement that it be in the revenue bond resolution or order. And if we say that that it doesn't have to be in the revenue bond resolution or order when it's pledged to it, then we create the situation where bonds, in essence, could become worthless because the fee or the tax is collaterally attached.
Then that's the question I asked you before. It seems to me the bonds, when they're issued, they have fees that have gone through this process. They're incontestable, and they stand alone support the bonds. I don't see anything in the statute that says the institution can't later pledge additional fees to more quickly reduce its debt obligations or its bond obligations. I mean, and that does not affect the standalone financing scheme that originally underpinned the bonds when they were issued.
Right. No, I agree that the statute itself doesn't address that exact circumstance of a later pledge.
And isn't that what happened here? This is a later pledge, wasn't it?
There was a later pledge, but I think we have to look at the 130.123 in context rather than just pulling out paragraph C as they would do and say, look, this we have this integrated statute 130.123 that essentially says that we can issue bonds to build buildings, we can charge fee for those, pledge those to the bonds, and essentially provides for self-liquidating bonds. And what they would have you believe that in this revenue bond provision, which it's an integrated statute, that the legislature there decided to put in an independent super fee provision that would allow for virtually any fee in any amount. The language of paragraph C is, you know, fees for the usage or availability of property. As the Court of Appeals noted, that could be virtually anything, you know, $100 a semester to use our sidewalks, you know, $1,000 to use our pencil sharpeners. Anything in any amount could be there. So would the legislature in a revenue bond statute have put this super fee provision? And I think that's unlikely.
You think the Attorney General would go through the revenue bond and conclude that it was adequately collateralized, but with a fee that shouldn't have been charged, and withhold approval of the bond?
I think that would be his obligation.
He'd say $18 is too much. It should have been $14.
Well, he has to determine whether the bonds are issued pursuant to law. If the bonds are issued with certain fees pledged to them, which are not legal, then that would arguably not be allowed by law.
But, I mean, he has to make that determination, right?
Yes.
Otherwise, the college could charge anything. So he has to decide in the course of approving these bonds, is $18 a reasonable technology fee, or should it be $12?
If it had been in the resolution which enacted the bonds, he would have had to make a determination as to the legality of it.
And if reasonableness of it.
Hmm?
The reasonableness of it.
Well, not the reasonableness of it.
Then what difference does it make whether he thinks it's too high or not?
I'm not suggesting what I'm suggesting to the court regarding the fact is we're trying to say, would they have enacted this provision as a super, it's essentially a super fee provision. On its face, it has no limits whatsoever.
So the question. And you say they could charge a $1,000 technology fee when there's no basis for that at all. And the Attorney General's going to stop that.
If the Attorney General had reviewed it, I would think as a matter of statutory construction and analyzing whether the technology fee was legal or not, he would look at that issue just as this court should to ask itself.
To see if the money is too much. You keep saying legal, but he has to look and see if $1,000 is too much.
It's not a matter of the amount of any particular fee. What I'm suggesting to you is that if we just look at the plain language of C and take it out of context of 130.123 and out of 130.123's context in the whole thing, it would be a super fee provision.
Okay.
So then the question becomes, would the legislature have put a super fee provision in a revenue bond?
And your answer
provision.
Is no.
No.
And you say the check on that is the Attorney General.
Well, the check on that is paragraphs B and D. Paragraph B requires, because it says the bonds must be payable from the fees.
I think you're misunderstanding his question. Assume that they had done this as part of the revenue bond and the Attorney General had passed on it. And let's suppose they put a $1,000 technology fee in there. His question is, where would the Attorney General get the authority to say $1,000 is too much? I think it should be $40.
I'm not suggesting that the Attorney General would have the right to question the amount of a particular fee unless the legislature had specifically, you know, put a limit on a particular fee. I'm saying that the Attorney General, if it had been in the revenue bond resolution, would have been charged with saying whether a technology fee at all of any amount could be charged.
Well, it can be under C. It can. I mean, you don't argue that.
Well, I'm saying that the technology fee falls within the face of the language of paragraph C.
And
I'm saying is...
You agree they can charge a fee. They just have to pledge it to the revenue bonds. That's your argument.
Yes, that's right. They could charge a fee for the availability of property, which this technology fee was, if they comply with B and D.
Right.
And they didn't comply with B from 1994 to 1998 because...
All I'm saying to you is, if they had complied with B and D, they could still have charged $1,000.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, then you say that they would never put a super fee in the statute and just allow them to charge anything, but then you say, but they could have charged anything as long as they pledged.
I'm sorry, I think the reasoning of the legislature was this. Nobody's going to issue revenue bonds just to be able, because of the financial obligation involved, just to be able to enact a fee. They're going to do revenue bonds as a carefully considered consideration on a lot of different factors, and then they'll decide. Then they can decide whether they want a specific fee, and they can pledge it to that. And so the people aren't going to just willy-nilly for generating more revenue issue revenue bond obligations. So that puts a significant limit on colleges, which is consistent with Chapter 54 and the prohibition in 5.4.0.
Well, that gets back to my other problem with your argument. You're basically saying that the only way that junior colleges can get funds to operate is through revenue bonds or financing, one of the three ways of financing. Why? What if a junior college is 30 years old, they don't need any more buildings, they want to do a few things here and there, and they want to raise fees to cover it? Where in the statutes does it say they can't do that?
Well, that brings us to 54.003 of the Education Code, which says that no institution of higher education and junior colleges to the extent, it says no institution of higher education in 5403 can enact any fee except as permitted by law, which is going to require a statutory authorization. The question then becomes, does 54.03 and Chapter 54 more generally apply to junior colleges? 54.002 says that Chapter 54 applies, which includes 5403, applies to junior colleges to the extent provided by Section 130.003B of the Education Code. When you get to 130.003B, it doesn't say anything on its face about the applicability of Chapter 54 to junior colleges. It just sets forth six criteria that junior colleges have to meet in order to be eligible for a share of the public appropriation of state money to junior colleges. The classes and the students' position is that what this means is that state-funded, that if a junior college makes the optional choice of taking state funding, then it's subjected to Chapter 54, just like all other state-funded institutions in the state of Texas. What the district wants to do is arbitrarily, of the six criteria, pick B4 and B5 and say, look, we think only these are relevant to junior colleges. So it only applies Chapter 54 to the extent that it sets minimum mandatory fees and their minimum amounts and the scholarships and tuition exemptions that have to be applied. I see that I'm out of time.
We have so many issues here. Let me ask you about a couple others. regards the court's judgment and the award to the class and the reservation of ruling as to what to do with any unclaimed proceeds, is there any evidence or argument in the case that the money was not used by the colleges for the purposes for which it was collected?
No.
So, I mean, the technology fee didn't go to do something wrong, and they used it on technology.
Let me say, I think that's indirectly. I mean, the money all went into a bank account, and they set up a sub-account on their books for this technology fund, and then as they bought technology in their normal course of business, they, you know, they debited against that same sub-account which they had credited. So in that sense, to the extent that, you know, it went into their bank account and they bought some technology and they sort of separately kept it on their books, yeah, it went for that purpose, but, you know, in a sense, that's an accounting type of thing.
The argument for a CPRE or a fluid recovery usually is that the wrongdoer ought not to get to keep the money that he took wrongly, and when other people got no benefit from that. But here it seems to me the students got benefit from the collection of the fees. You just contend they shouldn't have been charged. Why? Who's that money going to go to if it doesn't go back to the colleges?
Well, before I get to the merits of that, let me suggest that I think that decision is premature. The final judgment said that if there are any undeliverable funds, I mean, we have the individual names of these people. We have the last known addresses. We sent class notice out to these people. We did address updates. So we know that we can, and we can update those again, so that we know that we can reach, you know, tens and tens of thousands of people. But inevitably, you can never find everyone. So the question is, if there's any money left over, which we don't know, the trial court in the final judgment said he would consider four options. You know, one is CyPRE, one is ISG to the state, one is pro rata distribution of the funds to the located class members, and the fourth is reversion to the district.
So there's you say we should just wait on that and not jump into this.
I mean, generally, my impression is that we wait until there's a decision that actually has to be made, and we don't know if there's going to be a CyPRE award.
Second question, you agree you can't recover attorney fees under 38.001.
Right.
So what do you claim it under? The Declaratory Judgment Act?
We're saying, we said that the court, there was an award of about $271,000 in attorney's fees, and the court should reverse that.
But you still claim attorney fees.
Well, that's two different issues. That was attorney's fees the class recovered from the district. There was a separate issue of class counsel recovering attorney's fees from their clients out of the common fund, and that has not been challenged on appeal. Any other questions?
May it please the court. Justice Hecht, Mr. Mandel argues that under 123D, all of a fee must be pledged, and the amount is what need merely be sufficient, at least sufficient, to pay the bonds. But that's not what the opening sentence of 123D says. Each board shall be authorized to pledge all or any part of its revenues. So we're back to the situation where the fee is legal if a dollar of it is pledged, but allegedly not legal if none of it is pledged. Justice Owen, the case law cited in our brief at page 20, note 25, indicates that where the bonds have been approved by the Attorney General, not only the bonds are incontestable, but the fees pledged in support of those bonds are incontestable. The way this worked in the case of the district is the district had a master bond resolution that said, in essence, here is how we do revenue bonds and what it is we pledge. And then as each bond issue would come up, a supplemental bond resolution would be passed saying so many million in revenue bonds are hereby issued under the authority of and subject to the terms of the master bond resolution. These were not additional revenues pledged to existing bonds. These were refunding bonds, which were used to retire other bonds, but they were a new issue of bonds in which the technology fee was pledged as part of the pledged revenue. I think what the respondent's argument boils down to in major part is a focus on the title of Section 130.123C, Revenue Bonds. The government code says we're not supposed to function to focus on the title, and there's good reason for that. If you look at the structure of subchapter G of section of Chapter 130, you will see a variety of funding sources, ad valorem taxes and bonds anticipating those, and revenues. And the way 123C is written, it's intended to be a revenue bond statute that a bond underwriter or bond counsel can go to as the primary source of authority for revenue bonds. But the way it's written, it deals with revenues and what they may be used for more generally in the language of A and C. finally, on the issue of fees versus tuition, since at least 1985 and probably before, junior colleges have been unregulated in their charging of tuition. And so to say that this fee is illegal because it was called a fee, but would have been legal if it had been called tuition, is to make a very arbitrary statutory distinction. In fact, when this litigation erupted, the district solution was to abolish the technology fee and to increase its tuition charges by a corresponding amount so that that part of the tuition funded technology purchases. Surely, the validity of a fee and the district's liability should not turn on the label that is attached to that fee.
On immunity, your position is that the government can't be sued for collecting illegal taxes, can't be sued for refund.
Unless it has waived immunity. Now, at the state level, the state has set up a mechanism with respect to most taxes, a refund procedure. Also, for ad valorem taxes at the local level, they've set up a refund procedure. There is no refund procedure for this kind of a fee. So it would require some sort of legislative authorization or a waiver by the district through failure to assert sovereign immunity from liability.
And the bail bond cases were just wrong, or several courts of appeals cases?
The bail bond cases, yes. The bail bond cases proceed from a particular interpretation of Austin National Bank and Shepherd. If that's the correct interpretation, then they were right. Our belief is, if you go back and analyze those cases, that was not the correct interpretation.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in the second call. The court will take another.